Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We will be talking here just momentarily in this first hour of Focus with Palestinian activist and educator Sari Nasebi. He's just published a new memoir about his family, his life, his growing up, his academic career, and also about the long-running conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. The book is titled Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, and we'll be talking with him in just a moment. He's joining us by telephone. I didn't, before the news, get a very good chance to tell you about the second hour of the program today, so perhaps I'll take a moment to do that. There has been a winner now declared officially in presidential elections that were held Saturday in Nigeria, although international observers have said that fraud and intimidation in this voting was widespread. In the second hour of the program today, the 11 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about the election with Paul Lubeck. He's professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Cruz and among other things, has spent time over the years following the politics of Nigeria. We'll be talking about that. Also, we'll be talking about the decision of the United States to create a new Pentagon command covering Africa and what that says about how defense and strategic planners here in the United States are thinking about Africa. That will be in the second part of the show, so we hope you can stay with us through the morning. For this first hour of Focus 580, our guest is Sari Nasebi. He is someone who is well known as an educator, a political activist, a writer, someone who has been very involved in the Palestinian national cause for a long time now. He was educated at Oxford and at Harvard, has been known as an advocate of a two-state peace for the Palestinians and the Israelis. He is the author of a newly published memoir talking about his life, his childhood, his political activities, and about this conflict. And the book is titled Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life. It is published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and is out now. He's spending some time talking about the book, and we're pleased that he could spend the hour with us. He is, in addition to the other things that I've said, he is the president and professor of philosophy at Al-Quds University, which is the only Arab university in Jerusalem. He also served as the chief representative of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, in Jerusalem in 2001 and 2002, and now makes his home in Jerusalem. He is spending some time in the United States now to talk about the book. Questions are certainly welcome. We would like to give people the opportunity to call in and talk with our guest. All we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible, keep the program moving, but certainly listeners are welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to use. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Nasebi, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm fine as well.
Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time.
Well, thank you for inviting me to your show.
The conflict that we, I'm sure that we'll talk about, has been going on now for some time. And despite the fact that along the way there have been bright moments, times when there was reason for optimism, overall, sometimes one gets the feeling that simply nothing will change and that we could be having the same conversation years from now and that nothing would be very different. And I think what strikes me about you and about the things that you write in the book is that having said all that, you still believe that a peaceful solution, a settlement to this conflict, is possible.
Absolutely. I think that if you were to look at the history of the conflict right from its beginning, as you said, it's been going on for some time. And really, it's been going on for many, many years, right from the beginning, early part of the last century, actually. It's been going on slowly. If you compare between how people thought about each other at the time and how they thought about a possible solution, and how they think today, or how they have come to think over the past few years, I think you'll find that there's been progress in the sense that the both sides, the Israelis and the Palestinians, I believe, have come to realize that really you can only really achieve peace by each side accepting the claims to some extent of the other or compromising on one's own claims in order to reach peace with the other. And this is something that's new.
Well, that does it does seem to be that it has been a problem, and it, at least from my perspective, continues to be a problem that there are a lot of people on both sides of this conflict that are taking a maximalist position for whom the possibility of compromise doesn't seem to exist. They have their agendas, they have the things that they want, and there doesn't seem to be any willingness to compromise on those things. You feel that that's not...
I think maybe... No, you're right in a sense. Maybe there are two kinds of maximalists. Mm-hmm. There is the one kind of maximalist who is, if you like, a committed maximalist who will never reach and who does not want to reach a solution. But then there's another kind of maximalist, and that is the maximalist who declares to be so only because they believe that the other side is not prepared to make the necessary compromise. And if they were to come to believe that the other side indeed were to make compromise or come to make compromises, then they would change the position. And it is, I believe, this kind of maximalist which constitutes or who constitutes the majority on both sides. Mm-hmm. And it is therefore in that kind of maximalist, I think, one can have hope that change is possible.
I realize that we're talking in very, very general terms, but again, it seems that sometimes that part of the problem here is that perhaps there are people who are willing to talk and willing to make compromise, but that somehow they're expecting the other guy to go first.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly how I what I tried to explain just now, not very well, but that exactly what you just said. I think very often in a relationship between two parties, like in this case, each side believes that the other side is not really ready for peace, and therefore each side, because they believe this, are reticent themselves in declaring themselves to be open towards a peaceful resolution.
I'm interested in having you talk some about your childhood. You were born in East Jerusalem.
Well, actually, I was born in Damascus.
Oh.
My mother was, in fact, as a result of the war at the time, had to leave for safety, her country. So she left with her side of the family. And so she was in Damascus when I was born. And my father, at the time, had just been recuperating from having had his leg amputated in the fighting with the Israelis. And he was appointed at the time the youngest member of the so-called All-Palestine government. That was the first Palestinian government ever to have been formed. And he was sent to Cairo to serve as an officer in that government. And so he set himself up in Cairo. And my mother, together with my elder brother, sisters and brother, and the newest born, that's me, was born in Damascus, went to stay with my father in Cairo for the following 2 years. And after 2 or 3 years, my father and my mother decided that being in Cairo doesn't really serve anything but to maintain their distance from them, their own home country. So they decided to return to Jerusalem, and that's when I returned to Jerusalem. And since then, of course, I grew up in Jerusalem, and apart from studying abroad, I've lived in Jerusalem all my life. Mm.
So what was Jerusalem like when you were a boy?
It was a very small place. You must remember it was something like 50,000-60,000 in terms of population. Most of the people lived in the old city, in the old quarters. There was some development outside the city where I lived, but it was very close, contiguous with the city. It was, it was the kind of place where if you coughed in the street the next day, people would be calling up your mother to ask after your health because someone had said to someone that they'd seen you coughing in the street and wondering, therefore, what was wrong. It was a very small community, but the strangest thing about it, of course, was the sense that it was perched right at the end of the territory in which one had space to move. And one knew, and I knew, that at the end of this territory, at the edge, there was a wall. There was a territory called No Man's Land. And that across from this wall, across from this no man's land, there's a whole world, which was a peculiar world. Because on the one hand, it was a world which was of the past. It was a world of memories where, you know, my mother, for instance, or father would speak of their own youth, of their own land, of their own house, of their own the way that they grew up, and so on. And on the other hand, it was also a world in which there was the present, the enemy, that had displaced my people, my family. So it was a strange place to be living and to be growing up. Mm. And our house, the house I grew up in, was right on the border. So, you know, I could look across from the back garden onto what was called No Man's Land. And across No Man's Land, I would see these strange people. Actually, strange because at the time, well, still till today, that quarter in West Jerusalem, which I could look at, was the religious quarter. You know, it was called Mea Shearim, or 100 gates. And, you know, I looked across as a young child at the people who constituted my enemy, and all I could see was these people. And it was a peculiar thing to grow up with. And the first thing I wanted to do after 67 was simply to walk across that no man's land.
Your family has a very long history around Jerusalem. In fact, in one of the books, the very first chapter, the introductory line is, "When I was a child, it seemed that everywhere I went, I came across traces of my family's history in Jerusalem."
Well, you know, the family has we have our own story. We are descended, we believe, from first of all from a woman whose name we carry in the family name, Nusaybah. Or Nusaybe, and she is supposed to have been one of the women who received the Prophet Muhammad when he had to leave. He was driven out of Mecca by his peers, by his the tribesmen and the people of Mecca, and he had to leave and go to Medina with a few of his followers. And there in Medina, sort of another town in the Saudi Arabian desert, he was received by a few tribal leaders, including four women, and one of the four women was Nusaybah, this woman, who thereafter stayed close to the Prophet and fought alongside him, with him, defending him, and then, and had, you know, lost again, she was wounded and so on, so she was a mythical, a major figure in Islamic history by the name of Nusaybah or Mu'amara, and then a cousin of hers by the name of Ubadah is supposed to have come with the first caliph of Islam, Omar, the second caliph of Islam, Omar, who came to Jerusalem. He was the person who came to Jerusalem and took Jerusalem from Sophronius at the time, which was under the, you know, the Byzantine rule, so to speak. And Ubadah, the cousin, was appointed high judge. And, you know, we claim as a family that we're descended from that line. Now, to what extent this is true or not, I have no idea, but this is the kind of story we tell ourselves, and therefore, this is how we look at Jerusalem and how we view Jerusalem as having been still very much part of our tradition, our history, the blood that runs in our veins, in a sense, is also felt to run in the veins of the stones of the old city.
Mm. What do you think, you go back to, I'm having interested in having you talk a little bit more about your father and about what was happening there at the period, you know, 47, 48, at the end of the British Mandate. What he thought, what other people thought, what would happen then at that point, or perhaps not just what they thought would happen, but maybe what they had hoped would happen.
Well, you know, you must remember that the Palestinians at the time were not really, they're still not perhaps to a large extent, but they were not at the time very sophisticated in terms of their knowledge of what was going on around them in the world, in terms of their own capacities and so on. And all they knew at one point is that with the fall down of the Ottoman Empire, was that the British, who had in fact encouraged them along with other Arabs to rebel against the Ottoman rule, all they knew was that, you know, sooner or later they're going to become free, have their own free Arab state. And little did they know that in the meantime the British had in fact been making promises to other people, namely the Jewish people, to establish their own homeland. And this kind of duality, in fact, this kind of feeling betrayed also, was the cause of bitterness right from the beginning, and the cause of the constant fighting that was taking place between the Arabs in Palestine and the British and the incoming migrants, the Jewish population. And, the really sad thing, I believe sad, is that neither the Jews who were coming into Palestine, especially in a context of increasing anti-Semitism in Europe, you know, which led finally to the tragedy of the Holocaust, neither these Jews who were coming into Palestine in search for peace and stability and security know very much about the Palestinians living there, people like my own family or my grandparents and great-grandparents and so on, nor did my family, people, you know, the Palestinians who were living in Palestine at the time, really know very much about why the Jews were suddenly pouring in instead of the promise that was made them by the British. So this is a case of really two peoples being... I don't know how you describe it, people who were being thrown up against each other, each with a separate directive, each searching for something different, not really setting out to be enemies of one another, but by force of circumstance finding themselves to be fighting against each other. I think that's the sad tragedy of the fight between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I don't think people like my father or like my grandfather or people like that really knew to what extent or in what sense things would in fact in the end turn out. And
Certainly over the years, the leaders of many Arab governments have voiced their concern over the Palestinians, their situation, and their future. At the same time, it seems often that that's merely a matter of lip service, that if they really were interested, they perhaps would have made some different decisions. Do you think that at the time, if Arab governments were involved in a more constructive way, that that might have made some difference?
Well, this is, again, one of the other tragedies about history, that now when you look back on the history in retrospect, you realize that, in fact, it would have made far more sense for the Palestinians and for the Arabs, more generally, to try to have tried to accommodate the Jewish inflow, the Jewish search projects, if you like, for the establishment of a homeland. It would have made far more sense for Arab leaders at the time to do that, rather than to, you know, simply react in anger and frustration and rejection without any thought for the future and for the circumstance. Now, but this is the tragic part of this, that you can't really act rationally in many circumstances. And if you go back to that period, I mean, if I put myself in the position of my own great-grandparents or grandparents to see how I would have reacted, you know, you put yourself in a situation where you have a split personality, because on the one hand, I have the knowledge now what it is more rational to do, but on the other hand, I am placing myself in a situation where the emotion of the situation, the emotion of the of what was happening at the time, simply takes over and completely controls what I do. In other words, at the time, people were just reacting emotionally; they were not thinking. But I think that they couldn't perhaps really have done anything else but react in the way they did. Although, in retrospect, and even at the time, you know, it sounds like it would have been far better rationally to not have reacted that way.
Let me introduce again our guest for anyone who's just tuned in. We're talking with Sari Nusseibeh. He is president of Al-Quds University. He's also professor of philosophy there. It's the only Arab university in Jerusalem. He's been involved and with the Palestinian cause, national cause, for some time now. He was educated at both Oxford and Harvard and has also for some time been an advocate of the two-state solution to this ongoing conflict. He's the author of a newly published memoir about his life. and about the conflict that we're discussing. The title of his book is Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, and it is published by Farrar Straus Giroux. He makes his home in Jerusalem, but is now spending some time in the United States talking about the book. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems that relatively early on in your life, at least when you were at the point where you were going for university studies to Oxford and Harvard, that what you were interested in was being a scholar and pursuing the academic life, not being a political activist. And it seemed that you weren't particularly interested in politics.
Well, that's true. I mean, I grew up, in a sense, in a very politicized home, my parents' home. My father was very political. And the circumstances around me were very political. And in reaction against this, I wanted to get away from politics as much as possible. And I tried very hard to get away from politics. But the problem was, still is actually, that you really can't get away from politics if you're a Palestinian, if you're living in the kind of situation that we're living in. And this is not only true of me. I believe it's true of most Palestinians, all Palestinians. Whether you're a professor or a carpenter or a taxi driver or simply a farmer or what have you, you are compelled by the force of circumstance to take up a position in politics. And when I first went back home to start teaching locally at a Palestinian college, I had no, you know, I just wanted to be back. I wanted to lead a normal life as much as possible. I wanted to help my fellow countrymen by simply teaching at the university, you know, in a normal way. But very, very quickly, very soon, I found myself immersed in the political, you know, turmoil of my country without really meaning to. And just one thing led to another. And the first thing, for instance, I found myself compelled to do was to join the faculty union, you know, to create a faculty union for my colleagues at the university, simply to fight for union rights. And then soon after that, I found myself in opposition with the military authorities, who had come up with orders, the military orders, by which they tried to control our academic life. And, you know, purely on that basis, I stood up with colleagues of mine and tried to oppose it. So there's a major fight on the issue of academic freedom, to what extent we as Palestinians deserved to be academically free. And then one thing just led to another, from academic freedom to political freedom, and slowly I found myself in the big politics. And I think that's the destiny of most Palestinians, or all Palestinians who live under occupation. Hmm.
So certainly because of your experience living in and being educated in Britain and the United States, more likely than not, if you had wanted to become a college professor, chances are you probably could have had employment either of those places. Did that thought ever cross your mind?
It's a constant. It's a thought that constantly, you know, it's constantly in my mind. I'm always thinking it would be, or would have been, a beautiful thing to have done, a satisfactory thing to have done. But then I'm pulled by my sense that I need to be in my own country, and I need to do as much as I can for my people. Even in a small scale, in the scale that I can, and so I stay committed to and you know that's how it happened. So when I first graduated, I went back wanting to do this, and now of course I'm the president of a university. I enjoy the challenge of building up the university, of looking at the courses people are taking, of participating in the educational formation of young minds, of trying to build for a future through the, you know, participation in the building of the infrastructure at different levels. It's something that I feel, I suppose, being in the situation that I'm in, that I feel is a challenge that I must keep to. Although every now and again, I do come to the United States to spend a sabbatical, and you know, I normally enjoy myself. That's how the last book came out from such a sabbatical. Mm.
I know that here you spent a number of years, several years in the United States, and that there's one figure in American history that apparently touched you and became important to you, and that's Thomas Jefferson.
Well, you know, I went with my wife when we were still students to visit his, you know, to visit that place, and especially I was struck when I looked at the gravestone. You know, here lies Thomas Jefferson, that he participated in the writing of the Declaration of Independence, and that he also the other thing that he had put on the on his tombstone was the fact that, you know, the founder of the University of Virginia. And, you know, those two efforts in Jefferson's life seemed to me to just sum up my inner soul, what I was all about. You know, that I also wanted to participate in creating freedom for my people, for participate in the creation of an independence for my people, and that I wanted to participate also in the educational formation of the minds of young Palestinians. And, you know, I'm talking about a time long ago when I was still a PhD student, you know, 30 years ago, whenever it was, that this, in fact, struck me right to the heart. And it was just by accident or circumstance, I suppose, that one way or another, I ended up, indeed, on the one hand, first being involved in the effort in the first intifada to encourage Palestinians towards the Declaration of Independence. And then I found myself afterwards at the head of this new university and trying to set it up in Jerusalem, which is the you know, the hometown of my family for so many generations. So I don't know how history works, but it seems to work in very mysterious ways to connect me, you know, to connect my life later in at home with my visit that day to Jefferson's tomb.
Well, we have one caller here, at least one caller here, who would like to talk with you. We'll give them an opportunity to do that. This is someone who is in Champaign, our line number one.
Okay.
Hello.
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 Yes.
I was interested to hear you talk about growing up in Jerusalem and about the narrative about your family's history. And I wonder if I could, I sort of resonate with it, but in a very different way. And I wanted to bring it up and then have you talk about what I see is the two different narratives of in the issue. My mother grew up in Jerusalem, too. In fact, she grew up on the opposite side of where you grew up, much earlier in Mea Shearim, and her grandparents grew up there, and at least one generation earlier. So, and she's Jewish. The community that lived in Mea Shearim before, in the 20s, 30s, etc., used to regularly walk into the old city, into other parts of the old city, and there was a Jewish quarter in the old city, and so forth. I don't know how far back her family goes in what let's call it the Holy Land, at least to the 19th century, possibly earlier. But she has a narrative, and the family and the tradition has a narrative about the Holy Land, too, which is different than your narrative. After 48, one could no longer go across what was then called the Mendelbaum's Gate. You might have another name for it, but in any case, from Mea Shearim to the other parts of the old city. So now you have two peoples with two different narratives about the same land, and each seeing their narrative as the appropriate one, and the others as something incorrect or inadequate or whatever. So how do you bring together conflicting narratives? You touched on this at the beginning, but then I haven't heard you speak further about it, and I'd like to hear what you have to say there.
Well, simply by saying that the fact that there are two narratives does not mean there are contradictory narratives. It just means that there are two narratives, not just one narrative. And, you know, I presented the narrative of my side of the story, but never would I wish to exclude or negate or deny the narrative or narratives of, you know, the other side of the story. And you're quite right. The Jewish population, the Jews, have had a long-standing history with that country and with Jerusalem. And the Jewish population, the Jewish community that lived in Palestine before the creation of Israel, you know, was very much part and parcel of the country, just like everybody else who was there. And I would say that, you know, if one were to look at the overall history of the Jews and the Arabs in that part of the world, on the whole, one would find that, you know, the relations weren't bad. They started getting bad at some point in the 19th century. But I can, you know, recount stories that my parents would tell me of their very close friendships with the with various you know, with the Jewish community. In fact, you know, I would also go to as far as to say, and I mentioned that in the book, that, for example, I was told that in the records, the so-called Geniza records that were found in Egypt, in Cairo, there's a mention of the fact that the Jews were very happy when Omar, you know, the caliph I mentioned, came into Jerusalem, because they were hoping that this, in fact, you know, was the end of the prohibition against Jews to live in Jerusalem that had been placed there by the Byzantine Empire. So I think the Jews, and I think it is something that everybody should recognize, have had a long-standing, a very important, I call it in different places, existential history in the country, in the land, connected to Jerusalem in different ways. But the fact that I say this does not in any case undermine from the other fact that also, you know, the Arabs, the non-Jews, if you like, if you want to call them that, but that the Arabs and certainly the Muslims, the Palestinians, the Christians, and others also have had a long-standing history. I don't think one narrative necessarily excludes the other, and I think what we should do is to somehow work out a way to make those two narratives coexist, just as one tries to make two individuals, two different people, coexist in peace, in harmony, and in cooperation.
So do you see, realistically, not just idealistically, but realistically, the possibility of, well, let's talk from the Palestinian side, since that's the side you can speak from. Do you see realistically the possibility of the Palestinian population, or especially the Palestinian population that, let's say, supports Hamas, sees being able to accept an alternative narrative as coexisting with their narrative?
Well, I don't see any reason why that cannot happen. I think that people can have open minds, and I think if one does have an open mind and one does use it in order to look at reality not only from one's own perspective, but from different perspectives, I think that there's no reason to suppose why then one couldn't come to terms with other people's narratives. And just may I say that I don't actually consider, when I speak, that I speak from a Palestinian perspective. I speak primarily from my own personal perspective, and if I associate my perspective with anything at all, I try to associate it with just my being an individual human being first. And, you know, as an individual human being, I try to see my narrative. I try to see narratives of others. And there's no reason at all. I mean, I know that the Jews and the Muslims are now fighting, but I don't see any reason why they should continue to fight. I don't see any reason at all why they cannot come to terms with each other. And this has happened in the past, and it can happen again.
I need to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. We're into our last 15 minutes now. I have another caller I'd like to get to, and also to introduce, for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes, introduce again our guest. We're speaking this morning with Sari Nusseibeh. He's the president and professor of philosophy at Al-Quds University. It's the only Arab university in Jerusalem. He served as the chief representative of the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, in the city in 2001 and 2002, and has been involved in the Palestinian national cause for a long time. Is well known as an educator, as a writer, and a political leader. He is the author of a newly published memoir about his life growing up in Jerusalem. The book is Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, and it is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He lives in Jerusalem, but is now spending some time in the United States talking about the book. Questions are welcome again. People can help us by being brief. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone here in Champaign County, where we are. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Narratives are manipulated and they're ignored, and all sorts of things can happen in the retelling of history. And one can question how much of it is intentional and one isn't. But I just want to bring up one example that's fairly incendiary and has to do with, constantly we hear about the Mufti of Jerusalem making overtures to the Nazis. And, you know, if you look at what was happening at the time, there was the mandate, there was the colonial power, was the British, and they were the enemies, and it was the enemy of their enemies, so sort of thing. And we hear about that a fair amount. We don't hear that particular, you know, sort of qualification, not to say explanation of it, but we don't hear what Lenny Brenner has researched quite well in his book Zionism and the Age of the Dictators, is that there are factions of the Jewish resistance, Irgun particularly, who made overtures twice to the Nazis to collude with them against the who they saw as their opponents. So it just seems to me that what's elided and what's emphasized and what one hears about is that we have a powerful, mighty Wurlitzer of storytelling here in the West with the media machine, it seems to me. And things like Lenny Brenner's dedicated research, which he's obviously taken a lot of hits for, since it's so controversial. It's an extremely important contribution. I don't know how you'll react to that, but I have to hang up and run off. So thanks for...
Okay. Well, I think political leaders and military leaders are very cynical individuals, and I'm not surprised at all. I wouldn't be surprised if people in power will try to ally themselves with whoever in order to get on with implementing their projects. But regardless of, and I'm not actually an expert on history, so I have no idea to what extent all that, you know, whether the Mufti or the Irgun or whatever the story about them is true. But regardless of what went on in the past, I think what's important in addition to the past is to try and focus on the future and not to remain prisoners of one's history. And I think very often the Palestinians and the Israelis end up just being that, prisoners of previous acts, previous events, previous decisions made by previous leaders. And I think, you know, the time is right. The time is it's already, you know, maybe overdue for people to free themselves of all of that burden and to try and design a future which would be a future that would provide the people with sufficient space to live normal, ordinary lives. Lives with respect, with dignity, security, lives in which, you know, we can provide opportunities for our children, irrespective of nation, nationality, or religion, and so on. It seems that it's a great pity, a great tragedy, if human beings in whom there is the power to liberate themselves and to create such a new future, such a new world, if they nonetheless do not use that opportunity and allow themselves to continue to be prisoners of the past and of mutual blame and mutual hatred.
I'm interested in having you talk a bit about the rise of Hamas and what it was that that you think that people who voted for Hamas were saying, particularly about the older Palestinian leadership.
Well, I think everybody now realizes that there are two fronts, the internal front and the external front, that you know, people were getting fed up about with respect to our older leadership. On the internal front, everybody knows about the inefficiency, about the corruption, about the lack of building, of state building that that people had expected would happen with the establishment of their own independent authority. Quite clearly, the you know, the population which had fought, which had suffered occupation for such a long time, which had suffered being deprived of freedom and independence for such a long time, which had fought in order to become free and independent, had a dream, and this dream, as soon as the authority was established, just did not correspond with the reality that was established alongside this authority. And, you know, there were gaps, and people were therefore frustrated. That's at the on the internal level. And at the external level, again, people were hoping that with the establishment of the authority, that this would be the first step, and that we would go consistently from one phase to the next until finally we would reach the destination, which everybody assumed would be reached through the signing of the peace agreement, namely the end of occupation, the establishment of an independent state in the West Bank, Gaza, with East Jerusalem as its capital. And this did not materialize. The negotiations with Israel also did not go ahead. So the population in general, the Palestinians in general, got fed up and frustrated at the leadership for failing them on both counts, on the internal level and at the external level. And meantime, therefore, the alternative, which was at the time it was Hamas, which was an alternative that spoke about continued fighting, about purity, about cleanliness, clean government, and so on and so forth, seemed attractive at the time. So people just went for that. But I don't think it's I don't think that this trend is necessarily going to stay in this direction. And I think that very often we're blinded by ideologies and by names to what really exists out there, and what exists out there are ordinary human beings, you know, and ordinary human beings have ordinary needs and ordinary concerns, and you know, they're not very different. I know people think that sometimes, you know, if you're in the United States, for example, you look across the world, you know, across the Atlantic, thousands of miles away, and you assume that people on another continent are somehow constituted differently, but I can tell you, having crossed the Atlantic many times, that people are the same, and people have basic similar concerns, and they are human being concerns, and I think that people can be won over to the rule of moderation if people are or feel that they have acquired the dignity and the respect that they deserve.
I realize here I'm jumping around a bit in time, but there is something that, again, I'm interested in having you talk about. It, and this goes back to the late 1980s. Now, I have mentioned that you are known as a proponent of the two-state solution, but you did something back in the late 80s that actually caused up quite a stir, generated a lot of controversy, made a lot of people angry when you said, well, maybe what should happen here is that the Palestinians should recognize Israel, that Israel should make the occupied territories part of the country. In a sense, instead of a two-state solution, have a one-state solution. And what you were suggesting was that the Palestinians should become Israeli citizens.
That's correct. You see, the situation has been, is still, in some sense, one where, crudely, where Israel is both having its cake and wanting to eat it. So, on the one hand, you know, it rules over the West Bank, Gaza, over a population of over 3 million people now. And on the other hand, those people are, to all intents and purposes, disenfranchised. They do not have proper rights. We do not have proper rights in the sense that we are not masters of our own destiny in the same way, for instance, that an Israeli who is an Israeli citizen who votes for the Knesset has control or shares in having control over their destiny. And so what I have always said is that, you know, this is an unjust situation, clearly. This is a situation in which there's clearly inequality between one group and another, and that justice can only be brought about when equality is brought about, and equality can be brought about in one of two ways, that you can divide up the rights between the Israelis and the Palestinians geographically so that there are two states, or you can divide up the rights among Israelis and Palestinians on an individual basis or distributively so that each person will have the same right as each other person. Now, this second choice would imply, you know, a one-man, one-vote kind of approach, and that would basically mean that you have one state which is neither necessarily Jewish nor Arab, nor Muslim, nor what have you, but which would be a state for all its people and all its citizens and all its national communities. Now, you know, these choices still exist. The thing is that the Palestinian Arabs, when they think, when you talk to people and you try to market such an idea, will tell you, but we would prefer to have our own Palestinian Arab state. And likewise, Jews, when you talk to them, will tell you, we would now like to have our own Jewish state, which therefore leaves us with no other option, therefore, but to say, let us then have two states. Not meaning that, you know, forever such a situation will have to remain, but meaning, you know, at least let's divide up the rights geographically for now. Let's work hand in hand peacefully with each other, and let's see how, you know, mutually acceptable situations or modes of existence can evolve over time in the future. But the one thing that I've learned is that you cannot impose either one of the two solutions unilaterally, because you cannot force the Israelis to become members in one state, but neither can you force the Palestinians to be, for instance, to continue living under occupation or to live less than equals.
It seems that your belief that for there to be progress on this conflict, what has to happen is that representatives of both sides are going to have to talk to one another. It seems that, though, that this have been many times that this has landed you in trouble, on the one hand from people on the Palestinian side who didn't think that you should be talking with representatives of the Israeli government at all, and on the other hand, on the Israeli side, I'm not sure if distrust was going on or if somehow there were people who weren't interested in having talks and trying to make progress. It seems that often you were in a kind of in a figurative sense, maybe also in a literal sense, kind of in a no man's land in between the two sides, because you were interested in actually reaching out and trying to have some contact between the two sides.
Well, I mean, you know, in my experience, I've had, as you say, I've gone through very strange moments where I found myself being harassed by one side or the other in some form or another. And, you know, the incident you referred to earlier when I was attacked by people and physically attacked and beaten up and so on, mm-hmm. happened actually as a result of the news that came out Not that I was for a one-state solution, but because I had been in touch at the time with members from the Likud government, mm-hmm. Likud party, something that, you know, until then had been totally unheard of. And, of course, you know, if you think about it, 10 years later, contact between the Likud and the Palestinian leadership was, you know, a routine. But, you know, when I was involved in the first ever contacts, you know, when there were clandestine contacts, and it was revealed that I'd been involved in this, you know, people were up in arms. And so this is when I was, in fact, attacked. And, you know, similarly on the other side, when I've, in fact, been involved, as I think I had the right to be, in resisting the occupation, but always, in, you know, I've resisted it in ways that I believe are morally acceptable, morally legitimate, namely nonviolent means. I've landed myself in trouble with the Israeli side. And so, you know, more than once I was harassed, I was interrogated, I was picked up, I was prevented from traveling, I was put in jail for, you know, for a period of time, 3 months, and so on and so forth. So I've had it coming to me from both ways, from both ends.
We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say. There was much, much more in this book that I would encourage people to read. Once Upon a Country, A Palestinian Life, by our guest, Sari Nusseibeh. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's a memoir about his childhood, his adulthood, his involvement in the political issues that we've talked about. He's president of Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, makes his home there, and is now spending some time in the United States talking about the book. He's in New York today. Dr. Nusseibeh, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Dave, for having me, hosting me.